This year marks the 40th anniversary of the crash of United Airlines Flight 173 in an empty lot near the corner of Portland's Northeast 157th Avenue and East Burnside, just about 9 miles from where we are now in our KBOO studios. Our in-depth guest today, Julie Whipple, not only wrote a new book about the crash and its aftermath, but has a very personal connection to the event. Julie's father, Attorney Stuart M. Whipple, represented a young girl who survived the crash but lost her entire family, father, mother, and 2 sisters, traveling with her that late December day. The book is called Crash Course, Accidents Don't Just Happen, and we're fortunate to have Julie with us now to tell us more about it. Julie Whipple, thanks for coming into KBOO.
Happy to be here.
Julie, first, United Flight 173 was en route from JFK Airport in New York to Portland International Airport on December 28, 1978, with 189 people on board. After a scheduled stop in Denver, what happened as the plane approached the Portland airport?
They were very close to the airport. They could see the lights of the airport and were preparing for landing. And as they put the landing gear down, there were 2 enormous jolts that really rocked this giant aircraft. And, of course, it surprised everybody on board, but certainly the cockpit crew, which had never experienced anything like that before. So they went through all of the protocols for landing gear malfunction, but they still just could not understand what had happened. And so they began an hour's worth of troubleshooting.
The reason the plane crashed was because it ran out of fuel, correct?
That's correct.
And they were doing all this troubleshooting. They had plenty of fuel, except they didn't account for the necessary time required.
Right.
Plus, it's clear from your book that the troubleshooting itself burned actually more fuel than they intended to burn just on flying around. In other words, how come they didn't realize at the time that they were running out of fuel?
I think that's one of the questions that certainly dogged the investigators all the time. There was some indication that there were tolerances in the fuel indicating system that led the cockpit crew to believe that they had more fuel on board than they actually did. The problem is they were at a very low altitude at that point. They were in a holding pattern south of the airport, and they were flying with flaps extended. And
which burns more fuel.
Of course. So they, and just being in the lower altitude as well. So they were burning more fuel more rapidly than they would have in a sort of normal flying situation.
And their focus was not on how much fuel they had left. It was on fixing the
yes.
problem.
Yes, yes. And even though there were indications that they were checking the fuel, it just wasn't actually enough, obviously, to keep them safe. And I think they were all really surprised when the engines started flaming out. They were pretty close to the airport at that point, but not close enough.
Now there's an apartment complex there at 157th and East Burnside, but at that time it was an empty lot they
That's
landed
That's correct.
In.
There were 2 empty lots just across Burnside from each other. They made landfall in the first empty lot, which was just south of Burnside, skidded across the main thoroughfare, and ended up in a lot that was there, at the time. Now there is an apartment complex.
And of the 189 people on the flight, how many died in the crash?
10.
Now, even with the tragic number of dead, 10 is 10 too many, of course, you say in the book that the crash could have taken a much larger toll?
Oh, yes. To me, it's a miracle what happened, because, first of all, the crash happened at 6:15 at night. Of course, it was dark in late December, but it's still rush hour at that time. And Burnside, as we all know, is a main thoroughfare at that time. It was a 4-lane thoroughfare. Now we've got the MAX train. But nobody on the ground was killed. Somehow they made it across the boulevard and not one car was on it. Nobody was killed in the 2 houses that were in the lot on the south side. They were both empty at the time. And, of course, there was nobody on board in any houses across the lot. But the other thing is the aircraft, which is a huge aircraft, remained mostly intact. The main part that was destroyed was the cockpit and the first class section, which is where the little girl's family was. And a little bit, there was quite a lot of impact in the forward section of the coach, and there were some casualties there.
Now let's talk about the little girl and her family. Mm-hmm. You actually start the book with the story of the passenger Gabor Andor.
That's right.
And his family, his wife Rosina, three young daughters, including Elizabeth Andor, Lisa, as she's called. He was flying with his family to a new job in the Portland area, ironically enough, for United.
He was not flying into Portland for a new job. He actually lived in Vancouver and was an employee of United at the time. He'd been an employee of United for quite some period of time. He worked in the food services department, and so that's why he and his family were flying first class. They were given flight vouchers as an employee, and because there were some open seats in first class, this is where they were sitting.
As we mentioned, Gabor, Rosina, and two of the girls died, including the baby sister,
yes,
also named Rosina. The only survivor was Elizabeth, Lisa.
Right.
And when and how did your father, Stuart Whipple, get involved as Lisa Andor's attorney?
It was pretty soon after the crash. She was still in the hospital. She would end up spending almost a month in the hospital because her injuries were so severe. And so he actually visited her there and got to know her and also her family attorney, who actually had contacted my father in order to come in and help with this case.
And you write in the book of his first meeting with Lisa. What can you tell us a little bit about that? It was very touching.
He was struck by meeting her, obviously. It was a difficult vision for him. My father is the father of five children, and so I think any parent seeing a little child in that situation would feel badly about it. And so he remembers that she was still a very spunky child, and when he went in, she raised up a little stuffed animal that somebody had given her and said, "He's going to get you."
So she was pretty playful.
She was, yeah.
Now, many years later, your father presented you with his files, I should add voluminous files, for the case Elizabeth Andor versus United Airlines. He'd been attorney for over 60 years at that point.
Right.
This was about 5 years ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
What made the case so special for him? Was it that first meeting with Lisa?
It was certainly that, but also because the case dealt with some very big issues, not just in the aviation industry, but also legally, constitutionally. And so he was very interested in exploring all the issues that came out at trial. And I think that what I discovered in all of those boxes he gave me was a complex tale of an airplane crash, but also what happens afterwards and what happens to pretty much anybody who is injured in a, let's say, a setting where a corporation is involved, whether it's because of an unsafe practice or an unsafe product.
Now, after learning of those files, what inspired you to do further research and write the book? Did your dad kind of depend on you for that? You have a lot of experience as a journalist.
Well, I think that's part of the answer right there. I'm a journalist, and so I'm used to identifying stories, good stories. And what I saw in those boxes really piqued my interest. And I realized that it was a unique opportunity. I learned later how unique it was, because these days it's not easy to get the kind of information that was available to me about any kind of a trial. Most cases actually settle out of court, and people don't go to trial. for a lot of different reasons. Some of those reasons are because of it's more difficult now than it used to be, and especially for individuals, they are intimidated.
By the corporations that they're trying to sue or
absolutely.
Litigate against.
And they're intimidated by the prospect of going to a trial, about the expense, about the time. It's just not as common as it used to be.
You mentioned, you kind of implied, the research that you did, which is incredible. In an author's note, I read that the story is based on, among other sources, cockpit voice recording transcripts, trial depositions, NTSB investigation records, that's National Transportation Safety Board records, recollections from passengers, crew, and eyewitnesses who were there for the crash, saw the crash, news reports, and interviews. So were those difficult to get? I mean, that's a lot of sources from a lot of different areas.
Yeah. Research is a rabbit hole, I can tell you that. It one thing leads to another. And so, of course, we have such great research tools available today.
The internet.
Yeah. It's an amazing source because you really can just follow your nose down any number of pathways. So I certainly had that, and then of course there are actually a fair number of people who are survivors of the crash who are still alive and around, and so I was able to be in touch with them.
You write of a reunion too.
Yes,
and Lisa wasn't there, but the captain was there.
Yes,
huh?
the captain.
He actually survived.
He did survive.
Can you tell us a little bit about him? A very sad case, Captain Malvern McBroom.
Yeah.
He was 52 at the time. It was a very sad aftermath for him, even though he was a survivor.
He was blamed for the crash. Part of what came out of that was a complete disgrace for him. And coupled with the fact that he felt responsible for the 10 people, of course, who had been killed and all of the injuries on
board.
And
he lost his pilot license, too, so he wasn't able to fly again.
Yes, he was stripped of his pilot's license, and it really did destroy him. And he was never able to convince the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, or the NTSB to delve into the landing gear issue that kind of sparked the whole situation to begin with. And
was that the agencies were trying to protect United? Was that the reason for that? Or it seemed like a very fruitful area of research, investigation, that was ignored.
It was ignored. And I think part of the reason why was because they were really into this new idea of crew resource management. They really wanted to change cockpit communication culture. And they seized on that aspect of the crash. And it was kind of a timing thing. It just really all came together at that point in time, but that was the focus. They wanted to make sure that people in the cockpit communicated better. They would raise their concerns with a captain, whereas before captains were really seen as the head honcho in the cockpit, the guy that could do no wrong, and they really wanted to change that culture, and so I think that's one of the reasons why they kind of didn't delve into the landing gear issue. But that part came out in trial, and so this is an important part of my book.
The book at times reads like a thriller, so I didn't really want to get into the details of what happens later. But I am interested, or I think the listeners might be. Can you tell us what happened to Lisa Andor?
Yeah, she spent her early childhood she moved to Chicago. Her aunt basically became her guardian, and she grew up in that family because she had lost hers. But the trial and the whole legal aftermath took many years, as most people know. The crash happened in 1978. Her trial began in 1984 and really didn't end until 1986. After that, she grew up, and she now is living not in Chicago anymore. She has a family of her own, and she seems to be doing well enough, but she really does not... People get over an experience like that in their own ways is one of the things that I really learned about PTSD and traumatic experiences is that everybody deals with them very, very differently. And her trajectory has really been to try to just put it in the past, put it behind her. She doesn't want to talk about it. So you have to respect that.
Julie, how can listeners find out more about Crash Course and get a copy if they'd like?
Well, it's being sold at Powell's Books.
And you'll be reading there.
Right? I will be reading there on August 20th, and I'm looking forward to that.
And that's the downtown Powell's.
Yes, the downtown Powell's. Yeah. And one of the cool things about this particular reading is that there's also an audio book out for this book. And the audio book narrator is actually going to do the reading for me. Oh. She's a pro. She's award-winning. And so it's going to be kind of fun to have her actually do the reading.
And you were kind enough to give us an excerpt, which we'll post on the website.
Yes.
KBOO.fm.
Yeah, that's right. The prologue.
After the interview.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's
so,
correct.
So listeners can get that. A fascinating story. Julie Whipple, thanks very much for joining us here at KBOO today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
We've been talking with Portland-based writer and educator Julie Whipple about her new book, Crash Course, Accidents Don't Just Happen. You can learn more about Julie and her book at the website juliewhipple.com. And she'll be reading, as we said, from her book at Powell's, or actually she'll have somebody reading from it for her, Powell's downtown on Monday, August 20th at 7:30 p.m. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth.